Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes. Never miss an episode. And while you're there, rate and review us and let us know what you think about what we're doing. Today, we're talking with Bloomberg View columnist Eli Lake. He writes about national security, defense, surveillance, civil liberties, and related issues. Eli, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me. Hello, Reason Podcast listeners.
So, Eli, you recently, just earlier this week in the light of the Flynn resignation, you wrote a pretty fascinating column about, the ins and outs of Michael Flynn, the national security advisor. Give me your basic take. What was the point of your column?
The point of my column is that very sensitive information about Mike Flynn's apparently monitored communications and with the Russian ambassador were disclosed to the media from 9 current and former U.S. officials who that's some of the most sensitive information. And it looks like a kind of political coup, unless you mean to tell me that Mike Flynn really is involved with, as we've been told, Paul Manafort, the former campaign manager. If Flynn is involved with the rigging of the election with the Russians and trying to interfere, I consider that to be a very high crime. But none of that has been alleged of Mike Flynn. What Mike Flynn is being accused of doing is talking to the Russian ambassador a few weeks before he was going to become the national security advisor.
Right.
And
there's no law against that.
No, it's procedure. It would be expected. And I say this, by the way, a horrible Russophobe. I am a big neocon, Putin-hating war hawk on Russia. So the libertarians who are turned off by that, check the resume. Because I have criticized Trump for a long time. In fact, just last week, I wrote a column called Code Pink Republican, Donald Trump. My point here is that if Trump campaigned on the idea that he was going to try to reset relations with Russia, Mike Flynn is his national security advisor, of course he's going to reach out to the Russian ambassador,
right,
as much as I think that's bad policy.
And now
in and of itself is not evidence of a quid pro quo or anything else.
And we don't really have any idea of knowing what those conversations were about, right? Because we haven't seen actual, unfiltered transcripts. What we're relying on are kind of reports on people who have seen transcripts of intercepted communications and then reporters who, I guess, at various points have said they've seen the information.
Right. We're talking about, first of all, there are partial transcripts that are floating around, and even in the White House review. The White House review of the transcripts was incredibly unusual because Mike Flynn and his staff were not allowed to actually review them over the weekend. So he couldn't, defend himself. And it's all just, the whole thing seems incredibly fishy to me. Now, there is one school of thought that says this is the tip of the iceberg and the FBI has a whole lot more, so they feel emboldened to put this out there. And maybe that's true, because obviously we don't know. But I think there's a very strong possibility the other way, which is that Mike Flynn and Donald Trump are despised by not only the holdovers from the Obama administration, the Democratic Party, which is pretty self-apparent, but also mandarins of the national security state. During the election, a former acting CIA director and a former CIA director, an NSA director under Bush, Hayden, I'm talking about Mike Burrell. We saw Mike Vickers, who was a sort of former undersecretary of defense for intelligence, a very senior position, came out and wrote publicly op-eds that pretty much they thought that Donald Trump was an unwitting agent or patsy of Vladimir Putin. So you have, I think, in the outgoing sort of leaders of the intelligence community from the Obama administration, specifically John Brennan, somebody who, both Brennan and Flynn very much disliked themselves. And Flynn himself has cultivated a reputation in the last year or two, particularly since he left the government when he retired early from the DIA, and he was largely forced out, as somebody who's considered to be a hothead. He's somebody who is iconoclastic. And he, by the way, the feeling's mutual. He doesn't like the intelligence community. What I find interesting about this is that, of course he is on the right, and he has views that, or he's expressed at times views, such as his view on Islam, that I disagree with. I don't think think it's a famous tweet or something that Islam is not a religion. Yes, and it's become his rhetoric, particularly during the campaign, was very strident, although we did see a change in tone after the election from him, and he largely stayed out of the media spotlight. But yes, there's a whole lot of people in the intelligence community who really are worried, and we're extremely worried about Mike Flynn. And my point is that that all may well be good, but Trump won an election, and if they're using their access to the most sensitive information that which they eavesdropped, and then selectively disclosing that to paint Flynn to be a liar. And I think Flynn's side of the story is that he didn't lie. He legitimately did not remember this part of the phone conversation.
What he was being charged with was saying, hey, we're going to ease the sanctions. I mean, it was implied that he was cutting deals to undercut the sanctions that had been put in place.
But actually, the reporting from the New York Times and Washington Post, which I also want to say has been terrific. I mean, they're probably going to win prizes for it. And I wish I had the scoop. So my argument is not about disclosing classified information. It has everything to do with the people disclosing that classified information.
Well, then let's talk about that, because this gets us into the territory of the so-called deep state, where it's both within the intelligence community. And I guess the phrase deep state comes from originally from kind of Turkish origins, about a part of a government which is just immovable regardless of who's in power, that there's this, deeper or thicker operation and apparatus that will continue.
The national security state and its alumni and various and attenuated sort of businesses and so forth.
Yeah.
And industries and stuff, in a sense.
And this is kind of like people might see it in a clearer kind of profile, too, in terms of a country like Egypt, where it's not really clear that it matters who's president as long as the military still has control of all the contracts and all of different types of stuff. And there's an analog.
Well, I would say it matters a great deal who's president, but they can't be president if the military decides they don't want to.
And in the United States, I mean, we can expand it to, talk about the intelligence apparatus, the defense, the military-industrial complex, but also other aspects of a kind of Washington bureaucracy. But so, I don't think either of us is necessarily saying Michael Flynn was the perfect guy, or that we necessarily agree with much or even all or any of what he says. But there is something creepy when a guy in his position gets shot down, out of this type of stuff. What should we be most concerned about, with this whole episode?
Well, to borrow a popular phrase or verb at the moment, we should not normalize this practice, which is to say that my view on this is a bit nuanced and complicated. I would like to see a great easing of the laws of our state secrecy laws, and I think there should be fewer secrets the government should protect. I think it's been out of control for some time. And I'm very suspicious of having a class of people like a nomenclatura that has access to secret knowledge that gives them more influence and understanding of our real foreign policy than the average American. And I have written about these issues for years, and libertarians in particular should be really worried about that. And these are sort of the classic dangers of statism.
And this is where, realistically, it's interesting in the waning days of the election, and certainly in the aftermath, where we were treated to a lot of reports about how, the Russians had hacked the election, or charges that the Russians had hacked the election. Exactly what that meant wasn't clear. There were, charges that all of the WikiLeaks dumps about the DNC and John Podesta and whatnot were all actually spoon-fed to them by Russian intelligence services. And yet it was hard, and there were national security briefings about this, and it was kind of, I know I felt just as a citizen, much less as a libertarian, I wanted to know what the evidence was. And I realize, there's a certain amount where people will believe or not believe what they're going to think anyway. But we do live in a state where we're, at the same time that trust and confidence in governmental institutions are at all-time lows, we're being told more and more, no, on this really, really important stuff, you've got to trust us. We can't let you see it. We can't let you read any of the information, but you got to trust us. It was the Russians who did this, or somebody like Flynn did this, et cetera. It's a very disturbing situation.
On your point about that, there's a lot of evidence, I think, and I'm not even talking about the dossier. But there's a lot of reason to be suspicious, and there's a tremendous amount of unanswered questions. We have kind of an unprecedented situation where the president hasn't released his tax returns, and we have conflicting information from that interview with his sons, who said a lot of Russians are responsible for a lot of business, meaning, I gather, wealthy, super rich Russians who can kind of travel to the United States and owning Trump properties. But, so I still say I'm highly suspicious. I'm not on the sort of Frank Four or, I'm not as suspicious as some of the most people, but I count me as someone who thinks
none of this is, I'm not a Trump fan. I certainly didn't vote for him, and I couldn't imagine a world in which I would vote for Trump. But it's, at the same time, and we know that people like John Brennan is a liar. We know that, various members of the intelligence apparatus in America have lied before Congress. It's, it's getting a little bit hard, Eli, to listen to anything with, and believe it, which is incredibly corrosive. And I say that as somebody who's skeptical of government power, but, there's being a skeptic of government power, and then there's, being a skeptic of everything that comes out of both kind of the front end and the back end of the government. That's unprecedented.
If I get back to WikiLeaks, today in his press conference, Trump sort of strained to make this what I thought was a false comparison, where he said that, the difference between WikiLeaks and what has happened with Flynn is that it's classified material. WikiLeaks stuff is sort of embarrassing, but it's not like classified material, and that the big issue is the classification. That's totally wrong. WikiLeaks actually, in many ways, is kind of a different version of the same danger that I'm talking about with the national security state selectively disclosing things that they've eavesdropped on. And what I mean by that is it's the ability to publicize things that people thought were private, and that can cause enormous reputational damage and just fuck up your life. It is something, and I say that's what police states do. That's the thing. We're listening to everything, and at any given moment, we can sort of take it away from you.
Let me make a distinction, though, between, what WikiLeaks and, say, with the DNC stuff or the Podesta stuff. Mm-hmm. At least the documents were out there. And, for instance, so Hillary Clinton wouldn't, she didn't release the transcripts that she ordered to be taken of her, speeches in front of investment banks and audiences like that. WikiLeaks published DNC and Podesta summaries of that, many of which showed Hillary Clinton to be, literally, in one thing she said, come on, to Brazilian bankers, you have to have a public position and a private position. Everybody knows that. Let's be real. Nobody contested the authenticity of those documents. I agree that you can selectively leak certain things that put people on the defensive, et cetera. And I'm not – I like WikiLeaks. I like Edward Snowden. I like transparency.
WikiLeaks?
I like WikiLeaks, yeah.
They're reds.
WikiLeaks. They're reds. They're reds, and they also have had the influence – the effect of shaking up American government, and I think making it needs to be more accountable in a way. But in any case, at least you can look at the documents and they can be verified, or you could read them. And with this type of stuff, I agree with you completely.
That's a very good point. On the other side of this is that WikiLeaks, because they believe in the sort of mass and everything disclosure, in some ways is much more harmful to one's privacy.
Yes, I agree with that.
But the point is that it's the ability to sort of selectively take from this stuff and I think it's an extraordinary kind of power. The difference is, of course, is that WikiLeaks does not have, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of, eavesdropping infrastructure.
If they can
monitor all this fucking communication without you knowing it.
Yeah, but here's also the thing is that, like, Flynn knew he was being recorded. If anybody in the country would have known, it's standard operating procedure. I mean, they're bugging every conversation that's going in.
Because I'm not ready to report this yet, this question may be more complicated than you're positing right now, and I just want to put a pin in that now because I'm still trying to verify certain things.
Okay.
But on the point of, yes, I believe that Flynn is very aware of our vast ability to intercept communication. Yeah. He also, of course, would know that the Russian ambassador was
recording everything,
being monitored, because he was read into those programs. Of course he knew all that. Of course he did. And by the way, us talking about this is another thing that I've seen out there, which is, I don't think, correct. who cares if, of course the Russians knew that we were spying on them, and we know that they spy on us, and there is an understanding between governments about this kind of stuff, but it is really dangerous because that's the real danger. And it kind of reminds me of that debate we had after Snowden as a country, which was, we were so sensitive to this that just collecting it, but what was the danger of, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
If someone you don't know is collecting it, they never actually read it. And the only time they ever use it is when they have to catch child pornography, Al-Qaeda, you know what I mean? Like, good drug gangs. You know what I'm saying?
You know,
like,
God forbid you are a child pornographer who's a member of Al-Qaeda. I mean, you got no, there's nowhere to run. Yeah.
You're like an MS-13 child pornographer convert to ISIS. That's the worst possible thing, by the way. It's like in my den where I'm planning terror plots, I've got this thing going. It's like FBI is like, oh my God, we have to like monitor 7 ways to Sunday. Right? By the way, this is a little bit of an inside joke, but it's actually a serious point, which is that one of the reasons why the FBI, the NSA, and the U.S. government was able to build up such an impressive infrastructure to monitor and eavesdrop on all electronic communications was in order to catch child pornography in the 1990s, in the beginning of the internet. And by the way, we all share this. Child pornography is horrific and horrible, and people who do it should rot in hell and go to jail. I hate it. It's terrible. Everybody agrees. But the point is that this one horrific and terrible crime, which we can all 100% agree on, nobody wants to be on the wrong side of the child pornography bill, is one of the reasons, along with terrorism and drugs, and of course, standard kind of counter-espionage, right, and counterintelligence, why we have infrastructure. It is for those things, and really those things alone. Once it is abused for political reasons to undermine an elected government, that's terrible. We can't normalize that.
Well, isn't
it? We have to be very careful right now.
But let's move a little bit beyond that. I mean, do you believe in, and I realize this, do you believe in the deep state? Of course there's a deep state, but do you believe this is, and in your column for Bloomberg View, which I highly recommend people read everything that you write, especially when I disagree with you, I find it, incredibly valuable.
Thank you very much.
There is
even
a
like
deep
my Iran, my like Iran stuff.
Yeah, effete libertarians, cosmetarians, we're drinking our pink champagne.
Can I ask you a question? I don't understand, because I really feel, by the way, I have the cred to back this up. I'm pretty libertarian, Nick. I mean,
you wrote, as a matter of fact, and this gets down to the real issue of state power over the individual or the government, and not even the government, at writ large, but the government in the form of the president or a few individuals. You wrote a great piece for Reason about how the laws that went into
that was great. Yeah. That was great.
No, and it was, the laws that went into effect, immediately in the wake of 9/11. Are still in force now, and they allow the government to do, or the president to do legally, and I'm kind of making air quotes, what J. Edgar Hoover had to lie to each president from the 20s on to get away with, where it's like, you can pretty much do anything. And I mean, in that story and in other things, and this is what I'm getting to, we're amassing this body of secret law or hidden law where the president and people in the executive branch are saying, okay, well, we're writing this law, but we're interpreting it this way, but we're not going to tell anybody.
Right.
We're going to do this. We're going to have a kill list. It gets to a breaking point, it seems to me. And again, I say this as somebody, I'm libertarian. I'm not an anarchist. I believe we have government, that government can do good things. It should be small and it should be responsible. But we have gotten to a point over the past 15 years, just, without even going back to all of the stuff that was revealed during the Church Commission hearings in the 70s in World War II America, post-World War II America, where it is fucking hard to believe anything anybody is saying, because you have, Keith Alexander on the one hand lying, or you have James Comey, the FBI director, acting bizarrely. Right before the election, you have Donald Trump. You mentioned the press conference that he did today on Thursday, February 16th, where he was saying stuff that is like absolutely untrue. Like, where do we – so I guess my question here first is, is the deep state making a move With stuff like Flynn, is that them, you know, consciously working to kneecap, or, and I guess you use the term political assassination or soft coup in your article. Is that happening?
Soft coup, political assassination.
Okay. So, that happening? And then how do we combat it? That's the, you know,
First of all, we're not talking about a very serious thing. Okay. And I'm somebody who defended Petraeus because I didn't think him talking to Paula Broadwell or giving that very sensitive stuff to his mistress and everything. But it was more like the little details of it coming out, you know what I'm saying? So originally the FBI gets a tip on a cyber investigation, and then, oh my God, we discovered this other thing. Why does he have a secret account? Oh, he has a mistress. Does that mean he could be blackmailed? And this is always an issue in intelligence. But that's, you know, and so forth. But in this particular case with Flynn, this is all resting on we know he lied to the vice president, and we wonder if the Russians can blackmail him. And I guess I find that to be a very thin read in this case. It doesn't add up to me. Flynn legitimately believe that he does not remember it. That is what, if you read his resignation letter and you look at sort of, at least I would say, I think he gave one interview to the Daily Caller. That's my sense of it. Now, it could be that Flynn is this terrible Machiavellian scheming liar I don't think that's who he is. I've covered him journalistically for some time now, and I just don't think that that's the kind of person he is, I never thought that he was a patsy for the Russians. Again, though, I'm saying maybe if you have it, put it out there. That's the other thing. But at this point, it's just a whole bunch of suspicions, and it strikes me, I'm not saying it's necessarily a pretext, because I think that there are elements of the intelligence community, and to be honest, there is no monolithic deep state interest. That's a very important distinction I want to make. Mm-hmm. There are elements of the deep state, which I would call the FBI New York Bureau, that really wanted to make America great again back in November. And so they did their best to, leak out, on kind of internal investigations that had not yet been taken to a court that were highly damaging for Hillary Clinton, which I, at the time, thought was completely inappropriate and over the line. Because we don't want that either, right? But this is like that.
Well, and that and is. Would you extend that also to the to the dossier that was leaked, literally and figuratively, about Donald Trump?
Yes, I mean, I don't want to take again. I wanted to make this very clear. I'm not doing press criticism here. I have reported classified material before. And I am not going to put myself in on a high end pedestal and saying, well, I wouldn't have done that story.
Oh, yeah. Frankly, I'm not.
It's a red hot story, and I would have definitely done that
story.
I am not taking anything out from, I'm not saying CNN is fake news. I'm not going down that road. I'm saying that the people who start, who kind of are the sort of genesis of that story, are people who, you know what I'm saying? I don't think it's just by happenstance that, we've got to put this dossier in the thing, and then somebody finds out about it. You know what I'm saying? It's like these things are deliberate. When people talk to reporters, they're doing it for a reason.
Right.
And I love journalism. I'm just saying.
I agree completely. None of this. I don't fault BuzzFeed for running the story.
Yeah,
I didn't like the kind of justification the way they did it, because, you either check something out and stand behind it. But
journalism, Twitter, when the vultures start circling, and everyone is going to do their 1 minute of shame against you.
Yeah.
And I've been up and down on that. I know what that's all about. It is the worst.
Yeah.
So a little humiliating.
But it is.
Every time I see everybody piling on, you know what I mean? I'm like, come on, everybody.
Yeah. Well, but it's you mentioned Franklin Foer, the former editor of the New Republic, and I suspect that you're friends with him and whatnot, but he had to have been humiliated by the story that he published in Slate, where he was trying to prove that not only did Donald Trump have a connection with Russia, but they were basically, he had a server that went directly to the Kremlin in Trump Tower and whatnot. That seemed to be a pretty shitty story, and it fell apart pretty quickly. So I'm not saying journalists are blameless in any of this, but what we're talking about here is not simply the New York Times or a lesser institution reporting stuff. What is serious here are that government actors with, all over different parts of the government are selectively leaking stuff in a way that is, a real abuse of power. And the power that they're abusing is the power to surveil people. And, and for me, again, I like forced transparency. This is why I like WikiLeaks, and this is why among other reasons, I'm genuinely
complicated on WikiLeaks.
No, I get that.
I use WikiLeaks all the time. I'm complicated on it.
I get that.
A lot of those cables was good, right?
Yeah. And I was actually in one of the first big WikiLeaks dumps where they were talking about cables from all different countries. I was actually kind of proud of the United States, and Hillary Clinton was deeply implicated in a lot of these, that, unlike France in dealing with the Middle East and whatnot, that the United States pretty much, what they said in public is what they were doing in private. And, I'm not being naive here, but it's kind of nice to be part of a country that is actually on the up and up when it comes to a lot of things. Having said all of that, what I'm saying is that we get to a point, I think, and I think we have approached it, and in this press conference today, maybe we have crossed this line where when it becomes impossible to take seriously any of the news that you are getting from government sources, whether it's the president and the executive branch or the deep state or the Department of Education, it's hard to know where to turn next. And, as a libertarian, I salute on some level the corrosion of trust and confidence in government, but I also know I don't want to live in a low trust country because those are countries that are characterized by people cheating all the time, people not taking law seriously, and there's a breakdown of social comity throughout.
Well, obviously that's a disaster, and we don't want that. And the other thing is that having lived in Egypt where basic infrastructure and competence of the government is a failure as well. Part of that's because of the corruption, but some of it is just, when you're into that, when you live in more authoritarian states, they are far less efficient because nobody really wants to work and feels a sense of civic virtue. And
I imagine it is incredibly difficult to get a pothole filled in Alexandria.
Internet in 2005 and 2006 in Cairo was so frustrating. And it was like my main way of filing stories. So it was a great irritation. And there were all other issues too, like how you had to pay for your electricity and you could only use cash. So it was like so weird. But I digress. I think that's right. I am not as much of a statist as I think I was when we first met. And I've really moved to having a lot of great skepticism. I'm all for kind of rebuilding the American military, but I'm very skeptical that that would necessarily. I mean, I also think we should get rid of all these wasteful programs, starting with the F-35.
This is what we can rewatch episodes of MASH where Hawkeye and Trapper are making fun of press conferences that are held by the Army brass, but we are being shoved down our throats today. What is it, like 100 years into the building of the F-35, which we know by the time it's finally fully operational be obsolete anyway. It becomes almost nihilistic where it's like
here's the thing though where they kind of have us. Let's try to send you back to the issue of, okay, so on this issue though of surveillance, I really probably part way from the most recent readers and podcast listeners and the Greenwald set. I feel like we're kind of in a bind right now that, politically speaking, we can't tolerate, lots of terrorism in the streets. And I think it's become a thing where, and one of the ways that you can, one of the things you have to do to prevent it is you have to be able to monitor the communications of these people, and it's constantly sort of adapting and everything like that. And by the way, I'm not making an argument against allowing people to have encryption. I am all for encryption. So I guess I do come down on a lot of the libertarian side.
I think there's a necessity for this kind of
power, which is why it should be so disturbing that this trust that is needed to allow the government to be able to listen in is abused by selectively disclosing it for political reasons. Now, the only way that this, in my view, could be justified is if there really is so much more to this than we understand, and that Mike Flynn really is a Russian agent, which so far has not yet been proven.
Well, and wouldn't it even
that there would be terms under which, okay, good, we have to get rid of him
But then shouldn't it be, you would think if that was the case, and I realize that, the people who made this stuff public probably figured that Trump wouldn't buy it, but If you have serious arguments against or evidence against Flynn, wouldn't you have gone to the president or to some authorized channel, and it might have been Congress or, you know, the Senate leadership, and say, hey, look, we've got, you know, confidentially, we have so much stuff against him. You've got to move to get rid of him. You don't like do what they did. I mean, this is, you know, one of the arguments that still gets thrown up in Snowden's face is that, oh, why didn't you go through the authorized channels? And it's like, because he had seen what had happened to the people who had done it before. But these state actors, you know, there's no evidence that they, you know, went to Mitch McConnell or they went to people on the intelligence committee to say anything about, oh, yeah, Flynn. It's, you know, and it's one thing to say Flynn is nuts and he's an idiot and I don't want him to be a security advisor. It's another thing to actually have a claim against him other than bad judgment.
As I said, it's possible that this really damaging stuff has not yet, you know what I mean? Maybe mm-hmm. we have that hasn't leaked yet. I don't know. I find that somewhat unlikely, okay, because so much of it has at this point. And so then we're left with saying, oh, well, you know, it's a really big deal. He lied to the president when that could be interpreted in many different ways.
Yeah, he lied to the vice president.
And at that point, since this is what we're talking about, I'm like, and how did that justify leaking something like that? You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
What? And so I don't know. Like, it is something that I sort of took a zag while a lot of people were zigging on that. You know, from a political perspective, it's given a great momentum, obviously, to the Democrats. And but you have to watch this press conference, because at one point, Trump says, I have a new name for CNN. It's no longer fake news. It's very fake news. It's like, who is the president?
He is upping the ante.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
He spent 30 minutes on cable news television show.
And he identified Fox and Friends as the one true beacon of
the one show that's really been honest and good. You guys should try to be more like Fox and Friends. Like, it's just unbelievable. I we were talking about this before we did the podcast, but I'll say it for the podcast. On the one hand, this is deeply disturbing. I hate this term. We should not normalize this. Yeah. No. Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Professor Christoph.
Yeah.
You know, but on the other hand, it is sort of like, oh my God, did I just tune in? I just tuned into like John Coltrane at the Village Vanguard. You know, like, wow, this is an epic performance. We're never going to see anything like that again.
You
know, that's, and I'm not, you can have both thoughts in your head. You don't have to, you know what I mean? I can be very concerned and gravely worried about the Republic. And on the other hand, recognize that this is a once in a lifetime performer. Which is what he is.
You know, well, let's end on a quick commentary by you of, I mean, are you, and I guess maybe we're way past optimism and pessimism, but do you think, you know, American foreign policy in the entirety of the 21st century, and I think we might quibble around the edges, but I suspect that you would agree with me that, you know, American foreign policy, if not American policy period, has been kind of a disaster in the 21st century. Is there any indication that it's going to get better, you know, before 2020, have we just not even, you know, gotten near the bottom yet?
Wow, that is a very open-ended and difficult question.
And maybe the global situation doesn't depend as much on America as we think. That, you know, we obviously, you know, the Bush foreign policy, whatever its intentions, it failed to deliver on its promises in most ways. Obama was kind of a total disaster. In many ways, I don't think anybody is really going to remember John Kerry as Secretary of State, if he's lucky. But I mean,
they will remember John Kerry as a cautionary tale of what not to be for a statesman.
Yeah. No, I mean,
Kerry will be taught as a sort of example of like how never to, we never want a Secretary of State like that again.
Well, but I mean, it's like every time you think, okay, this is absolute darkness, it can get a little darker. You know, it's just, I mean, but do you
I mean,
think
I'm a little bit right? Do you know I don't even call him a podcaster because he's so much more, but Dan Carlin, we've talked about him before.
Yeah, sure.
So his first Common Sense is his political show.
Right.
The first show that he did after the Trump one is he had a list of here are the things that would happen. We have to be that would sort of. I would take to the streets, you know, like sort of this is when we really have to organize and so forth. And we have to distinguish that between things that we may disagree with for kind of pretty conventional policy reasons or, you know, normal politics or things that we don't like because it's kind of new. And I'm not, this is not a way to kind of give them, but I'm saying, the travel ban was not a Muslim. And that's good, right? That he didn't try to do that. And by the way, the courts, you know, have stopped it, and he's obeying the courts.
Right.
So what I try to do is sort of just keep in mind that you have to save your outrage, so to speak.
Yeah, no, and that, and there's a huge amount of Trump kind of pant wetting and pant shitting over, like, oh my God, you know, Betsy DeVos didn't even go to public schools, and she's going to run the Department of Education. We got to be out in the streets, man.
She wants guns in schools for bears. Right?
Yeah, it's, you know, no, actually, she wants kids to be able to go to schools taught by bears. You know, it's like, yeah,
right.
there's a level of, you know, there's a level of outrage which
hand,
is
like,
fake, but then there are things, you know, like,
well,
you know,
I
if Trump
on the foreign policy side with Trump. If he does some deal with Russia and he does Yalta Part 2, like where they he really everything's up for grabs and we're going to negotiate everything and it and it ends
well,
up
what
with
do
us
you, yeah, but what do you
betraying
think?
Our like NATO allies.
Yeah, but what
that would be a
our NATO allies, our NATO freeloaders, our NATO freeloaders.
What?
Do you think was it a bad thing that Mad Dog Mattis, and already we're in a Philip K. Dick novel where. You know, this is, I mean, it's like, you know, Fellini meets Philip K. Dick, where we have Mad Dog Mattis, you know, running something. But, like, are you mad that he said to NATO, to the NATO countries, you've really got to, like, open up your wallets, otherwise our commitment might go soft? Is that, now, I mean, you're not saying that that in itself is a reason to go in the streets, but you're saying if Trump says, hey, you know what, Estonia, you know, we're kind of tired of them anyway, you can have Estonia. You can have most of Poland.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I mean, I think what Dan Carlin was getting at is fundamental threats to our democracy. Like if he started arresting journalists or members of the opposition.
Right. Or if he told
like
the court.
Like, you know,
yeah, no,
like
if he told the court, kind of like Andrew Jackson with the, you know, after the Cherokee won in the Supreme Court, if he told the Supreme Court to go fuck itself, you know, about the travel.
There
ban.
You go. Defying a court order. That would be one. That would be a biggie. I actually forget the exact list right now, but it was. You should go back and listen to all of his hardcore histories as well as what I disagree with him, by the way. He's a big Russia dove and he's like much more in the kind of Greenwald side on stuff than I am. But I listen to it because it's one of the smartest shows.
And I am much more, I'm much more willing to live with a Russian American, you know, kind of, bromance. I suspect that, well, then I know than you are, but there's also a difference between, you know, there are levels of what would actually be a true threat to, you know, the American way of life and the way American way of government and representation in government and things like that, for sure.
Well, there's a part of me, I'm not quite extreme on it, but I do think that it's serious to worry about the accumulation and expansion of a massive administrative national security state. And what that means for sort of the American life, because I do think, not to over-romanticize it, that, you know, I like to think of our country as, you know, one where we really are able to go wherever we want and live, you know, by our own sort of pursuit of happiness.
Sure.
And part of that means, like, when you have an overweening state that it tries to regulate all aspects of our lives and communities and everything, and I'm not dystopian about it. I'm pretty squishy when it comes to this, so I make lots of exceptions and sort of don't consider it, but I do think it's something that we should worry about. At the same time, whenever and I maybe can end it on this, whenever anybody talks about how they want to return to some sort of anything, you know, in the early 20th century or the 19th century or something like that, I'm like, no, you don't. No, you don't.
I want to live in a police state.
Like,
yeah, I
want to. You don't want that at all.
I want to live in a police state.
You want to go back to the world how they built the railroad. No, yeah. No, you don't.
No, well, and you know, we don't even have to get into the technology question, but it's like, I want to live in an honest police state where they use water cannons on people or tort. You know, it's
right,
like, no,
exactly
no.
Right.
You know, it's like we're always living, or at least in our lifetimes, and I think that includes our parents and grandparents, we know that things are getting better on most levels, but there are serious threats. And that this is, you know, when you start to, for me, what Trump is kind of clarifying, both in what he says himself and brings out in people, but then the way people are reacting to him. What happens when you corrode so much of the everyday trust and confidence of basic institutions in America? You know, things can get a little dicey. And, you know, the fact is that You know, it has nothing to do with Trump, but the police in America have been shown to, you know, be awful in many situations, whether we're talking about civil asset forfeiture or whether we're talking about the ways in which police departments use speeding tickets and other kind of, you know, things as revenue generators. And then you look at the banks.
Right. Thank you, Radley Palco.
Yeah, no, yeah, but okay. It's true. You know, it's, I mean, these are serious, serious threats.
No,
because we, you know, and you,
oh, by the way,
yeah.
No,
I know you agree. I'm just saying.
Since we're on this topic, if anybody's listening, because I bet there's some overlap and you're part of that Chapo weird Twitter community.
Yes.
I just want to say, when I did my I Love the Police tweet raps, it was meant with some level of irony. And you guys ought to know about irony, since that's all you do.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That was not to you, Nick, but I'm just saying, I get this all the time. They're retweeting. I did a rap. You know, love the police. You know what I mean? Like, you know, instead of F the police.
Yeah.
Who cares? Who cares? It was in 2010 or whatever. Who gives a, you know, come on.
Wow. All right. You sound like Trotsky in Mexico City, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, it's like, of course I agree with you on the need. I'm with you. We should be skeptical of the police, but we also shouldn't, like, reactively hate them.
I agree.
Sorry to be a grown-up about it.
Well, this is the question of, you know, I think that faces America's kind of public sector at this point, because it's true of schools, it's true of police, it's true of you know, healthcare, in many places, it's true of the security state, which, you know, and we want a national defense program that keeps us safe and that, you know, helps make the world a little less shitty. You know, they have a lot of trust building to redo, and it's going to be hard to do it. And I don't know, you know, if we've ever managed to do that in the wake of the Church Commission in the 70s. It's not clear at all that the FBI, if you read books by people like Tim Weiner, you know, the FBI did not fundamentally restructure and reform itself to regain the trust of Americans.
But I will say this, the Soviets never really were able to make much inroads into our politics under J. Edgar Hoover. Terrible guy in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Real threat to our democracy.
Totally.
Kind of wrapping up to the original topic.
Yeah.
And in many ways, somebody who was like a little authoritarian.
Oh, he was totally. But
I agree. That he could,
but
he could black. He blackmailed the Kennedys. He could blackmail.
But on another level, it was like, well, you know, he didn't, you know, maybe the communists weren't going to make very good inroads for other reasons. But he also, you know, he let the mafia run wild for decades because he didn't believe in them. He didn't believe that Italians were smart enough to do that. And he was preoccupied with homosexuals and communists, who he typically thought were the same thing. And all I'm saying is, you know, in Wiener's book, Enemies, which is a great history of the FBI from a couple of years ago, Louis Free is the real villain. He's worse than J. Edgar Hoover because – and what I'm getting at here is just not that the FBI is particularly awful, but that – you know, there's a moment where people in government, and this is beyond partisanship and beyond politics, like they really need to cop to the fact that they have rightly lost the trust of a lot of people, and they need to become transparent and behave in a way that regains that confidence. And I think it's particularly difficult with surveillance and national security issues, because there are going to be deep secrets that everybody can't know. And I agree. You know, I think you were getting towards this, you know, with somebody like Edward Snowden, I'm glad that we learned what he revealed, but the world will go insane if everybody who works for the NSA or the CIA or the FBI starts to pull a Snowden.
There's a lot of stuff that Snowden disclosed that was very bad for the country, and given the fact that it is our common defense,
I would
like to see a little bit more anger at Snowden.
I agree. Or let me put it this way. You know, people like William Binney and Kirk Wiebe, you know, agree with you on that.
Sure.
They say that it's one thing for him to release things about American operations.
Right.
It's another thing for him to talk about things happening overseas. Regardless of that, what I'm saying, you know, and I think we agree that you can't have a surveillance, you know, a good national intelligence program if everybody is pulling a Snowden all the time. But then you get to the question of like, well, you know, the problem is that they're doing lots of really bad stuff and they're not good at what they're doing also, because how the hell Snowden got in and out so quickly is kind of a mystery. But in any case, I think we will leave it here. I'm not sure that we accomplished everything other than starting another.
This was a great podcast.
I
everybody in the fake news media that thinks this podcast wasn't great He doesn't have any idea.
You know what?
What happened in this election? Ask yourself why you got this election so wrong. The very fake news.
I was going to say, you know what we shoot for in this podcast, and you know we don't hit it very often, only about seven or eight times out of ten. But we try to be the Fox and Friends of podcasts. And
if we can hit that, that's like what I'm saying. Yeah, that's the goal. Yeah. We don't always make that mark, but we try.
We've been talking with Eli Lake. He writes about national defense and security and surveillance for Bloomberg View. Eli, thank you so much for talking to Reason.
Thank you for having me, Reason.
This has been the Reason Podcast. And for Reason, I am Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us when you're there. And we will talk to you again real soon.